Okay, so we haven't had any real funny ones yet, and I'm sure there's one coming soon. Anyway, first question, what's the difference, i.e. how can you tell the difference between nibbida and numbness? And what are the arising and cessation conditions of each of these? Okay, nibbida is actually, I call it samsara's ejection seat. In other words, it's that force which throws you off from the wheel of existence. So there's a part of negativity towards nibbida. And you know, I've got a running argument with Bhikkhu Bodhi because he wants to translate nibbida as something like disenchantment or revulsion. But it's something quite strong because one of the sayings, suttas, is just like if you've got a sore on your body and it's oozing pus and dirty, you know, smelly stuff, you'd have nibbida towards it. And nibbida, as he says, there's a problem there. So, you know, there's a problem, you've got to do something about it. You know, your problem is you're going to get reborn again. Do you want to get reborn again? Think about it. Do you really want to be wearing nappies again? And every time you ask for something, your mother shoves this thing in your mouth and you can't say anything and you've got to go to school all over again. So are you really willing to face that again? No way. So that's called nibbida. That's a problem. Numbness is the fact that you've either been sitting too long, you can't feel your legs. Or the fact that, you know, you're just in some sort of denial, so you don't want to feel anything, so emotionally. So numbness is something totally different. So nibbida is when you actually see the mess you've got into by getting reborn again. You know, you've got to do something about it. It's like finding out, you wake up one morning and, my goodness, this is jail. I'm in prison. And there's a way out. So as soon as you realize you're in prison, my goodness, you know, you want to do something to get out. But if you've been born in prison, and if you spend your whole life in prison, if you've grown up in prison, and all your friends are in prison, you think, the prison, this is the real world. What's wrong with prison? You know, I've got a nice husband, a fellow prisoner in the jail. You know, I've got all these nice little kids who are also in jail. You know, I've got my... And many people live in jail, you know. They've got these guards outside their house. You can tell they're in jail. They think the guards are there to keep the criminals out of the house, but no, it's to keep you inside. On which side of the bars are you really? Are you free? Or are you in prison? What do we mean by being free? Are you really free from all your family and possessions? Are you a prisoner of your family? A prisoner of your possessions? Are you free from all of your wealth? Or are you a prisoner of your wealth? It's very known, many people understand this. If you get more and more wealthy, you get less and less free. The more money you have, the higher the walls of the prison which surrounds you. You become owned by your wealth. You don't own your possessions anymore. They own you. Ah, how did I get myself into this mess? So that way, just, you can have your possessions, but middle way, not too much. And if you do really become wealthy, give it away quickly before you get imprisoned by it. That's why we've got these donation boxes. These are not because we need the money, just compassion for you guys. So be careful. So that's what nibbida is. You see, just what do I want to do this for? You talk about letting go of the will so that one lets... Sorry? Yeah. Ah, if you're the difference now between the apathy, which is just, oh, life is okay. That's just in denial to the Dhamma. Nibbida is based on seeing the truth of things. So apathy is almost like, you can't see the bus is running off the cliff. And nibbida is seeing the bus is running off the cliff, so you better jump out quickly. So to jump out quickly, that's, you know, the result of nipitta. So a lot of apathy is you know, basically denial. Denial in the truth of the things. If you want to find out the difference, one of the great meditations on the walking path, and we haven't talked too much about walking meditation, we just started this retreat, but go in these paths, you know, in these rooms here. We have been so kind to you setting up this retreat center. We've actually laid out the red carpet for you doing walking meditation. That's what a 5-star this retreat this is. So you can go on the red carpet. And that red carpet, it doesn't go anywhere. You go to the end and you turn around, you come back again. Now what a wonderful teaching that is. You walk for half an hour, and where do you get anywhere? You get to the place where you started. But, even better than that, we have this way of doing walking meditation, which I encourage you, and from this you'll know the difference between apathy and nibbida. You've heard this before. As you begin walk, as your left foot steps forward, you recite to yourself the mantra, I will die. And the right foot moves, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. When you start that, you have apathy. No big deal, yeah, I know that. But after a while, actually that's true. I will die, that's for sure. And don't just look at the old people in this room, it means you too. I will die, that's for sure, I will die, that's for sure. And then you get the sense of, actually this is important. This is actually the most vital thing, your imminent death. Imminent death? What is it, 1 day? 1 year? 10 years? How fast has this year gone? It's November already. You know, just a few days ago we celebrated New Year. And it's already the end of the year almost. 1 whole year was gone. That's a huge percentage of your life. And how many moments have you got left? Sometimes I look into the horizon, I can see my coffin coming closer and closer. I can see it over there coming. It's getting closer. Your coffin is approaching. So when you think of that, then the apathy disappears and there's a sense of urgency. And that's called nibbida. We're in denial of so much of our life. I'm not going to die, at least not today anyway. I've got plenty of time. So you're apathetic to doing something about the situation you found yourself in. But once you do, I will die, that's for sure, 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 after a while it just gets into you. That's why people usually laugh, first of all, when I suggest that. And then after a while it's not a laughing matter anymore. You come across fear, and after fear comes nibbida. Give it a try. I will die, that's for sure. It's a brilliant way. But please don't die until the end of the retreat. It's very, very troublesome for us, and especially the caretaker. So when you go home, die then, but please not here. You talk about letting go of the world so that one lets go of suffering. Often I need to put my foot down about things that are not right, and often it ruffles feathers. Consequently, it brings me suffering. How does one put their foot down and not suffer at the same time? I'm sure there are times when you need to make a stand on things that may bring about disharmony. Yeah, bhikkhuni ordination. I put my foot down on that. I never did. I was just sucked into it by the other nuns. They sort of got me to do it. I was just a pawn. No, it's just the right thing to do. So letting go of the will, but actually, that's a good actually idea. Sometimes I look back upon that, I didn't have any choice, you just had to do it. So letting go of the will doesn't mean just sit here like a zombie and never move again. It's understanding the will does not come from you. You know, you're just an actor on this stage, and you're just responding just to, you know, what needs to be done from moment to moment. That's why I don't have any plans. I haven't got some sort of grand evil plan to take over the world or anything. You know, my plan actually is just, you know, just to answer the next question. That's as far as my plan goes. I don't know what I'm going to do afterwards. So, letting go of the will means understanding the will doesn't come from you, and just letting the things evolve, let things be, let things just roll on. And then you find out that, yeah, sometimes you put your foot down, but it's not really putting your foot down, because arguing and telling people off, that doesn't usually work. I don't put the foot down with the monks of the monastery, I try and inspire and encourage them. Buddhas only show the way. The Buddha never put his foot down. He just, this is the rule, take it or leave it, and that's about it. So that's how you put your foot down if you're a monk. Now if you're ever in the workforce and you've got to sort of tell somebody off, this, and you can do this without causing suffering and disharmony. And it's the sandwich method which I keep talking about. The sandwich method is, if you've got to tell somebody off at work, or you've got to tell your husband off, or your wife, or your kid off, praise them first of all. You know, the person you're working with, you know, that, oh, you're such a wonderful secretary. You're sort of always here on time, you're well presented, and, you know, you're so friendly, and you make a wonderful cup of coffee in the morning, but you can't type. But nevertheless, you know, I think we can help you by sending you to a course. We value you so much, you're such a nice person that we don't mind actually paying for the course to teach you how to type, secretary. So what are we actually doing there? Praise, 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 praise. At least five pieces of praise. Because when you praise somebody, the first time they don't really believe it. The second time, oh, maybe they may like me. The third time, you know, oh, give me more. And the fifth time, their ears are wide open, and so is their mind, as they're waiting for the next, you know, sugary praise. And so when all their ears and their mind is open, that's when you hit them with the criticism. And then they actually hear it. I was telling Ajahn Brahmadi this evening at tea time over in the monastery, that I met this guy, I forget where, it was only last week, and he'd been married for such a long time, and he said, yeah, you know, just after a couple of years of married life, you learn how to not to listen to your wife when she's speaking. She says she knows how to turn off. And so, yeah, you know, he's looking at her. Yeah. But he's not listening, he's just turned off. He said that's what you learn after a couple of years of married life. And don't think only husbands do that. Wives do that as well. You get very skilled at that. But, this is, if you don't listen, it's because you don't want to listen. Imagine someone's praising you. We want to listen then. So your ears are open, your mind is open. So praise, 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 praise. Then you hit them, you know, with the message. But so they don't get upset and think, no, don't like me. Praise, 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 praise afterwards. So you try that when you go home to your partner. You know, darling, you know, such a wonderful husband. You know, he's such a good provider. You know, I'm so lucky to have met someone like you. You know, you're so good looking. And, you know, you're just so, you know, your toilet habits are very nice. But, you know, your mistress, you have to dump her. But, you know, I really want the marriage to keep going, and you're a great person. Whatever, that's going into extremes. But you know that they won't listen if you criticize them straight away. So do the sandwich method, it works really, really well. And then you can actually tell people off, and there's no sense of disharmony or suffering. So it's a brilliant way, and actually it's... That's related to what the Buddha said about right speech. You know, part of the Eightfold Path. And so it's wonderful to actually understand the Buddha understood. If you're going to talk to somebody, give words which are, what is it called? It's pleasing to the ear, which go to the heart, which are very kind. You can still tell people off, but with kindness, and so they accept it. So that's how you put your foot down. When, Ajahn, when sitting or walking, meditating, I'm either thinking or having anger coming up, sometimes with regret or sadness. Please help. Thank you. Okay, what to do is allow yourself to get angry. So be kind to your anger. Because too many people, they get angry, and they get angry at being angry. We call that in Buddhism double dukkha. Single dukkha is enough. So you get angry. So be kind to your anger. We call that the simile of the anger-eating demon It's a great simile. I know it's in opening the door of your heart, but don't think opening the door of your heart is a kid's book and you want to get onto the real stuff, you know, about jhanas and enlightenment. That's a brilliant story told by the Buddha. Long time ago, in a palace, in a country which is no longer exists, there was, the emperor had gone away, and this big monster, this demon, came into the palace. And he was so frightening and terrible that all the soldiers and guards which were supposed to be protecting the palace, they froze in fear and allowing this monster, this demon, to walk right through the palace and sit on the emperor's throne. Get out of here, they said. Who do you think you are sitting on our emperor's throne? At those words, the monster grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, and his language got worse. And that upset him. Get out of here. You don't belong. Who do you think you are? Another unkind word, thought or deed, and the demon grew more ugly. The stench got worse, and it got more offensive and an inch bigger every time. And by the time the emperor came back, this demon was huge. He took up half the throne room. And he was so ugly, that even, what did I say in the book? I think even DreamWorks could not come up with an ugly demon like that. And as for the stench coming off that monster, it was so bad it would make a maggot throw up and vomit. And the language was worse than you'd hear in Sydney if the Australians beat the English beat the Australians in the Ashes cricket coming up this year. Well, it was terrible language anyway. But the emperor was smart, which is why he was the emperor. He knew exactly what to do. He said, "Welcome, demon. Thank you for coming to visit me. Has anyone got you anything to drink yet? Or something to eat? Maybe we can get you some noodles. I saw some noodles in the kitchen today. And we have all these wonderful sauces for you. We've got hot sauces. We've got sort of salty sauces. What would you like to eat?" And at those sincere, kind words, the demon grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. And that was a signal which showed everyone in the palace what they were doing wrong. Instead of saying, "Get out of here, you don't belong," they were kind to the demon. Someone came up and gave them a foot massage. Ooh, that felt really nice. Someone massaged the scales on the back of his neck. Someone asked him if he wanted a pizza, monster size. They asked him if he wanted a cup of tea. We've got Sri Lankan tea, we've got chamomile, or if you really want, we've got very strong tea with condensed milk. "Oh," said the demon, "that's lovely." And at every kind word, deed or act, the demon grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. Until the demon was so tiny, just one more kind act, and the monster vanished totally away. And that was adapted from a story told by the Buddha in the Udana. And the Buddha said, we call such demons anger-eating demons. They feed on ill will. And you give them anger, they grow an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, more offensive, and harder to deal with. So we don't give anger-eating demons more ill will. So if you've got anger coming up, it's an anger-eating demon. Don't give it more anger. So welcome, anger. Thank you for coming up. You can stay with me. I let you be. The door of my heart is open to you, anger. Come on, let's get really angry. And that totally sort of undermines sort of anger. And it just vanishes because you give it kindness. Or if you get regret or sadness, again, that's an anger-eating demon as well. So be sad. See if you can really be sad. See if you can get the Guinness Book of Records entry for the saddest person in the whole world. Because that degree of psychology means the anger eating demon of sadness or ill will itself just vanishes. But if you think, I shouldn't be angry, I don't want to be sad, and that really is sad, I tell people, if ever you're depressed, milk it for all it's worth. You get a doctor's letter so you don't have to go to work. You can stay at home and watch the cricket or the movies. You get all this sympathy for your friends. So if you're depressed, enjoy it. And of course, if you start enjoying depression, it disappears. So that's why it goes away. So, let it be and be kind to it. It's just emotions coming through, and just let them come through. Dear Ajahn, regarding the story about when you didn't try to control the mind between 3 to 4 p.m. and it became peaceful, how did you then develop and apply that insight, especially at that time? What I did was I stopped trying to control the mind. Because I realized when I tried to control the mind, I was being negative towards however it was at this moment. I was creating suffering. The definition of suffering is the space between where you are and where you want to be. And if I'm here and I don't want to be here, I don't want to have this stupid mind, I don't want to have a sad mind, I don't want to have an angry mind. That is suffering. I want to be somewhere else. Suffering is the space between where you are and where you want to be. So after we figured that out, I just, wherever I am, that's where I want to be. And then there's no suffering anymore. Wherever you are, that's where you want to be. So if you're angry, I want to be here with my anger. And that's peace. There's no problem anymore. When I'm sad, I just want to be here with my sadness. There's no suffering anymore because I don't want to be anywhere else except here. That's called contentment, and all sadness, all anger just disappears. They can't withstand such peace and contentment. So here we go, next question. Can stress and disturbance be used as an indicator that there is controlling going on? Yes. When mindfulness is too weak to see controlling and fault find directly? Yes. In the word of the Buddha, which I read out, is a wonderful translation, where the Buddha said, this is a path without groaning. So if you're groaning, you've lost the path. Okay? Or, sometimes I say, there are two types of meditation. And we're not talking about samatha vipassana, that stupid old argument. What we're talking about is second noble truth meditation and third noble truth meditation. The second noble truth is craving leads to suffering. So if you're doing second noble truth meditation, you must be wanting something. And what does craving produce? Suffering. So if you're suffering in your meditation, it must be because you're craving something. If you're getting frustrated, disappointed, upset, at your wit's end, that means you've been doing second noble truth meditation, stupid. If there's suffering, it's because you've been doing second noble truth meditation. You've been wanting something. The other type of meditation is third noble truth meditation. Letting go of craving leads to nibbana, enlightenment. So if you're getting peaceful and happy, well done. You've been doing third noble truth meditation. Letting go. So the amount of stress you have, if you've got disturbance and stress, that means that you have been doing second noble truth meditation. So don't do that second noble truth meditation. Suffering. Do the third noble truth. I recommend it. Just let go. Let go of all craving. Be content. Be happy to be here, no matter where you happen to be. Just reduce that space between where you are and where you want to be. And then, there's no more problem. No wanting. No suffering. Peace at last. So if you're suffering, you got it wrong. What is the cause of delusion? Taints and causes of taints is delusion. the cause of delusion is the hindrances. You know, the five hindrances of desire. That's number one again. Desire, the big thing. So you don't see what's really there. You see what you want to see. And a good example of that is getting married and falling in love. When you fall in love, your partner is just so charming. They are so beautiful and lovely in every which way. Even the way they pick their nose is just so delightful, so cute. And after 3 or 4 years, when you get really upset and you want to get a divorce, you wonder, why on earth did I marry such a person? What did I see in them? I must have been crazy. And you can't see anything redeeming in that person at all. If any of you have gone through a separation divorce, they're both a delusion. They haven't changed. They weren't so beautiful and delightful and charming before. That was delusion. And they're not so terrible and evil now. That's delusion as well. So those are where we know that we are adding what we expect to see, not what's truly there. I still remember the first time I drank alcohol. In England you had to be 18 to go into a pub and order a pint of beer. You know what it is, rites of passage for boys. I was about 14. And I went there to get my first English beer. It was very scary, but very exciting. At last I could drink this stuff, which everybody was raving about. And I couldn't believe how awful it tasted. I think, what's the big deal? Why do people like this stuff? It's disgusting. But after about 4 or 5 months, I began to like it. And I remember that. Just the truth of the matter was, it was actually disgusting. But peer pressure made me change my perception to like the stuff. So, is it tasty? Is it delicious? Or is it not delicious? Or is that all delusion? So much of life, what you think is happiness, is suffering. What many people think is suffering actually is happiness. That's a teaching of the Aryas. The Buddha said, what the noble ones, enlightened ones say is suffering, everyone else says is happiness. What other people say is happiness, the enlightened ones say is suffering. You get it the wrong way around. What about sex? Is that happiness or suffering? People in the world say it's happiness, that's why you spend so much time trying to get it. The noble ones say that's suffering. When I actually say that and go, I wrote that in the book, and people think, you are really crazy, Ajahn Brahm, what do you mean it's suffering? Just because you've been celibate for 36 years, and what do you know? You're really weird. But I ask you to contemplate next time, is that really pleasure or happiness? Or is that suffering? Challenge the accepted wisdom. And then there's actually something to that. The Buddha actually told Ananda, he said, the only reason why people get into so much sex is a perversion of perception. You just bend perception because everyone else says it's fun. That you make it fun, and it becomes fun. You perceive it as joy and happiness and pleasure. But the reality is something different. The peer pressure is so strong. I remember just as a kid, I was very fortunate, I never got into drugs. But a lot of my friends did. And I remember one, there used to be, for those of you my age, there used to be this myth going around that if you took a banana peel and put it in aluminium foil and kept it for a couple of days, it would actually turn into something similar to LSD. And of course, one of my friends decided to give it a try. And he did it. We asked him, well, how was it? He said, oh yeah, just the same. It was really high. I really had a good feeling. And it was actually a joke. It was a myth. One of these things which people just spread around, which had no scientific basis at all. But he got high because he expected it. And that's actually a delusion. Never underestimate the power of the mind. What you think is out there
is actually what you perceive, not what's really out there. So that's cause of delusion. First of all, desire, ill will, denial, I don't want to see. Sloth and torpor, it's just too dull to see. Restlessness, you're not there quick enough, you're not spend long enough to see. And lastly, doubt. Is this right? Is this a nimitta? Is it not a nimitta? Look, those of you experiencing nimittas during this retreat, the rule of thumb is 99% of the time it is a nimitta. But how many people they see a light and it can't be a nimitta? They doubt. So please, all those things stop you seeing the truth. So the five hindrances are the cause of delusion, which is why you have to abandon those five hindrances first of all before you can see the Dhamma, see the truth. And you can't abandon those five hindrances by thinking or by studying. There's only one way you abandon those five hindrances, jhana. That's why I teach jhana here. It's a waste of time doing vipassana, doing insight practice. If you haven't had jhanas, the hindrances are still active. What you think is true ain't true. Dear Ajahn, what is mind? What is the content of the mind? How this mind works? Please explain. Thank you. No. Yes, I can. What is the mind? Once there was an emperor, and this emperor, no one knew who he was, or she was, or it was. Because every time the emperor appeared in public, the emperor was clothed, it was covered with five garments. The emperor had these big boots, which went right up to his thigh. I think I saw them in the shop, and called gladiator boots, is that right? Yeah, is that true? Gladiator boots, have I got it correct? No, I don't know anyway. But they were big boots anyway, which went right up to his thigh, or her thigh, or its thigh. And he had these pants, his trousers, which overlapped the top of his boots and went way above his belly button. And he had his jacket on. The bottom of the jacket overlapped the trousers with long sleeve to his wrist and a high collar. He had gloves on each hand which overlapped the sleeves. And lastly, he had a big helmet on which covered the top of his jacket and no one could see the face. So that the emperor was covered with his five pieces of clothing which totally obscured any detail. So no one knew whether it was a man or a woman or a monkey or a girl or a boy or a robot. They couldn't see, so they didn't know what the emperor was. So the only way you could find what the emperor was to take off the five clothes and see what was underneath. And in that simile, the emperor is called your mind. The thing which is running the show. The most important part of you. But it's covered with the five senses. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching. So the only way you can find out what this mind is to take off those five senses. And that's what we do also with meditation. After a while, you don't see anything. Seeing is turned off. You can't hear. In the deep meditation, you can't hear the sound of the bell, you can't hear anything. You can't smell, taste, and even your body disappears, you can't feel anything. Your five senses have gone. Then what's left is the mind, is the citta. That is the only time you can really understand what this mind is. With the experience when the five senses vanish. What's left is called this mind. And what is the content of the mind? Remember, this mind has two parts, the knower and the doer. You can call that its content. But after a while, the doer vanishes and stops totally. And you realize that's not essential to the mind. It's just something which comes and goes. So as if you're peeling it away, and now you've got the knower. Just pure consciousness. As you go deep in the meditation, that vanishes too. So the content of the mind is nothing. So it's like a bubble. You prick it, poof, and it's gone, leaving no residue. So the mind is what you experience when the five senses disappear. and the content of the mind. Nothing. Emptiness. Oh, what a relief. And how this mind works. Because of will, especially, it keeps a consciousness looking here, looking there, trying to find happiness, meaning, pleasure, always keeping you busy, never allowing you to be still, because it's like will knows, if it didn't keep you on the move, the delusion will be broken, and all the power of will will be disappeared. It has to keep you moving, because if you stay still long enough, you'll see through the scam, and will have no more power over you. And even your consciousness will vanish. The illusion will be seen. And that's it. Bye-bye mind. Because it doesn't belong to you. It's not you. It's got nothing to do with you. Even your mind is none of your business. There we go. That's what mind is. I heard that someone asked the Buddha why some beings get enlightened and some don't. He said, because of training perceptions of beautiful. Do I remember that correctly? I can't remember exactly, but some people get enlightened, some people don't. But which one are you? Are you of those group who are going to get enlightened, or the group who are not going to get enlightened? It's interesting, we said that the training of perception of the beautiful. The beautiful, the positive, is an important part of the meditation. In other words, if you start complaining and seeing faults in things, seeing the two bad bricks in the wall always, seeing the fact that this one person in your cottage who always snores and makes a noise, and can you please tell Danya to blacklist them so they can't come ever again, that type of fault-finding mind, that will be your hindrance. The big hindrance, when you always complain and see faults in things, seeing the beautiful things, is actually giving people a break. They're okay, they're human beings. Now, giving the food a break, giving the fact that your hot water might not be working. Oh, just there's so many hot water heaters, one's got a break from time to time. And then give yourself a break. So you're not so fault-finding on yourself. Because when you have fine faults, you have to fix it up, which means you have business to be done. When there's business, there's no peace, there's no stillness. So don't find fault. Instead of the fault-finding mind, we have this is good enough mind. So look and say, this is good enough. You've got water. Many people in the world don't have water. So you should be so grateful you've got water to drink and to wash. So this is good enough. So many people don't have a place to meditate. This is a 5-star meditation retreat. Many places in the world you don't have this. So my goodness, this is good enough. I always remember the story of here in Perth. There was a painter. And he was on a motorbike. It wasn't his fault. Someone crashed into him, fell off his bike, and he injured his hand so badly, had to have it amputated. And that was the hand he used to paint. His whole career, the thing he loved most in life, he lost. He really got depressed. And he decided as soon as he was out of hospital, he would kill himself. And that's what he tried to do. He went up to, we have this big street, St. George's Terrace, over in Perth, where all the high rises are. He went in the elevator, find some office, and went out on the balcony, on the ledge, to throw himself off. He was about to throw himself off when he saw, down on the bottom, on the sidewalk, he saw a man with no arms, dancing down the street. And that really shocked him. I've only lost a hand, and there is a guy with no arms at all, and he's dancing for joy. And I'm depressed. So he gave up his desire to commit suicide. He rushed to the elevator, got down quickly and ran after that man. He caught him up. It's easy to notice in the crowd. And he said, "You just saved my life. I was a painter, I lost a hand, and I was depressed. And there were you, no arms at all, dancing down the street for joy. Tell me your secret." And the armless man said, "Sir, I wasn't dancing for joy, I was just trying to scratch my bum. That's an old joke, but it's one of my favourite ones. How else can an armless man scratch his backside? He said, like, ooh. So, that means that just have a positive mind, it's good enough. So that's actually how you manage to sort of get nice meditation, the sign of the beautiful, no fault finding. And then you have a lovely meditation. There you go. Can you please explain how to recognize when the foundation of meditation stages are firm enough to move on, and also how to recognize the signpost? You don't move on. Stay put. Don't move anywhere. Otherwise, if you move on, you're always moving. Isn't that your life? Life is always moving on to the next thing. Have you got your list of things you're going to do later on this evening after you've come out from here? You're always moving on to something else. You're never really here. From one retreat to another retreat, to a job, from one meal to another meal, one movie to another movie. You're always on the move. Never stop your whole life. And even when you're meditating, you always move on from one stage to stage two to stage three. First jhana to second jhana. Move on from samma to vipassana. Move on from stream winning to something. Just, that's a waste of time. Stop moving. Stay where you are. But I'm sick and I'm restless and I'm angry. Exactly. You've been moving. Stop with your anger. Stay still. Stand your ground. Here I stand and become enlightened with my stupid mind. That's actually what happens. So you stop. You don't move on. You stay still. And you find you move in, never on. The next stage of meditation is always within the stage you're on now. So every one of you has jhana, has enlightenment, right in the middle of this moment you're experiencing right now. You can only go into the center of this. You'll find all the jhanas, enlightenment you ever want. It's in the center of this. So your job is to stand still. And just watch the mind move in. And you go through the stages that way. Never move on. So it's never, what should I do next? That's the most stupid thought which arises in a meditator. If that happens in you, what should I do next? Alarm bells, red flags, stupid. That's the wrong idea. You're blowing it. What am I doing now? Stay with what you're doing now. So not going on to something else. Stay with what you have and go into it. There you'll find enlightenment, nowhere else. So that's, it happens naturally. You don't do anything. You sit there and it all happens to you. I've often given the simile that meditation is like going on an aircraft, on Buddha Air. On Buddha Air, once you're in your seat, strapped in, you don't have to do anything. Because on Buddha Air, you're sitting there, and then this flight attendant comes up and said, "Madam, would you like the delightful breath? Because we have that as a special offer to all our customers today." They say, "Oh, thank you very much." And so you don't go searching for the beautiful breath, the delightful breath. The flight attendant gives it to you. Because that's what happens to me. I go on Singapore Airlines or Thai or whatever. I'm just sitting there and they come up and say, "Do you want a cup of tea?" Okay, thank you very much. It's like on Buddha Air. You don't get cups of tea. You get limiters. "We'd like a limiter, sir?" A gold one, please. Because, you know, I had a white one this morning. A gold one would be nice this afternoon. Thank you very much. And so they come in a few minutes and give you a nice gold limiter. Well, that's very nice. Thank you very much. So you're sitting there. You don't go look for pajamas. Another flight attendant comes up. "First, second, or third, or fourth, sir?" "I'll have third today, thank you." They just come and bring it to you. And then later on in the flight, you know, before you land, they come around and say, "Special offer to all our passengers on this service. Stream winning. Do you want stream winning?" "Oh yeah, thank you very much." And they just give it. It's all part of the ticket. You don't have to pay any extra. It's not like those AirAsia where you don't get anything on the flight.
This is Air Buddha, Buddha Air. You get everything you need. You're sitting there and says you want no returning. Oh, thank you very much. And just before you land, a special gift for everybody. They come out and distribute the arahat for everybody on Buddha Air. And that's it. You don't do anything. The flight attendants come and bring it to you. We call that not the in-flight service, the insight service. It just comes to you. So actually, that is what happens. So don't go searching for it. Stay your ground and it comes to you. Like I said, I think it was that this morning, I told a story of that when I went to get a cup of tea in the morning. And if I'd have stayed still, it would have come to me, but I missed it. I have a question related to this morning's talk. If this body does not belong to us, I think it is like a rented property. So are we allowed to destroy it when we are sick? And that's a very good thing. If you destroy your property because you don't like it, what will happen to you? You still have to pay it somewhere or other down the line, don't you? If you've got a rented car, you know, from Avis or Harts, and you get fed up with your car, so you smash it. Now, you're going to have to pay for that. Okay. I have learned many different walking meditation techniques and I'm now getting confused when I'm practicing. Could you describe your teaching for walking meditation? Yes. Left, right, left, right. Turn around, left, right, left, right, left, right. Keep it simple. But basically, start at the beginning, which is always the best place to start. Put your eyes open about 2 meters in front, so you know where you're going. You don't sort of veer off the path and hit somebody else. And just start walking. Present moment awareness. Silence. Don't go thinking to yourself or working out all your problems. And just feel the left foot rise and go forward. You don't have to note and say lifting, lifting, rising, rising, because that just gets too much. Just know it and feel all the sensations of the foot moving. And when that left foot is finished walking, when it meets the ground, what does it feel like to have your bare foot meet the carpet? And feel the weight change from one leg to another, allowing your right foot freedom to lift up and move forward. How does it move up? Does it go straight up? Does it go forward a bit? My one, when I lift up, it goes up and backwards a bit. And just notice just the way your foot moves forward. And then what it does to go down. What part of the foot touches the ground first? What last? So you become interested in just a natural movement of one step. Natural. You don't try and go fast or slow. Keep it at a natural pace. I know that many Vipassana meditators do slow walking. And sometimes I've seen in these halls, people have a competition to see who can go slowest. As they're looking sideways at the other person, I must have gone slower because I've got to be more mindful than the person next to me. So don't look at other people. Your job is just to be a natural walker and just be aware of the feet as they rise and pass and as they move. And just do that much. That's enough for now. Ajahn Brahm. This is nice. I freak out not being able to progress or something at some point of meditation. Piece of advice. How do I overcome this fear? Not being able to, what does that say? Please be kind and write clearly. This must be in, I think it's Bahasa Malaysia or something. Poor, I don't know. Not be able to at some point in meditation. Anyway, not being able to do or. Anyway, if you get any fear in meditation at all, you know, it's always because fear is always is fear of losing something. That's what fear actually comes from. Something we're attached to has been taken away from us. And so find out what it is you're afraid of losing and realize you don't own that anyway, so what the hell? And you can let it go. You don't own your body, you don't own your mind, so just let it go. What are you afraid of losing? So, but whoever asked that question, I couldn't really understand it, so you can maybe try again writing it tomorrow. Dear Ajahn, I'm new to meditation. My goal in life is to make 100 billion Australian dollars or Singapore, or how can meditation help me make money? Many thanks. If you stick with me, and you follow all these instructions instead of just, you know, being silly, follow all the instructions, get to this beautiful breath, and get to the nimittas, and get into these jhanas, and after a jhana, when you come out, all you need to say is, next lottery number. Because your mind is very powerful. If you don't like lottery numbers, stock market. And the numbers will appear as a beautiful nimitta in there. And you'll be able to forecast, because your mind is so strong, which way it's going to go. You can make a fortune, 100 million at least. But one thing I would ask, 10%. So there you can make $100 million. But once you get jhanas, you realize that what is the greatest wealth is not wanting money, but having no wants. It's great being a monk. Every now and again, like the last time, it was close to my birthday. I think it was Burr, you asked me, Ajahn Brahm, what do you want? Can I get you something? And I really was trying to sort of think, to try and give her the opportunity to make some good karma, but I couldn't think of anything I wanted. So I said, no, don't want anything. Now that's the sign of a rich person. Someone who wants for nothing. How many people in the world, if someone sincerely said, is there anything I can get for you? Anything you want? And they were sincere and they really wanted to help, and you said, no, nothing I want. Could you say that? Even if you had 100 million, you couldn't say that. You want 200 million. You're only about 27th in Forbes list, and you want to go up more. So, if you really want to be rich, want for nothing. Next question. Oh, interesting one. My husband is a Muslim. If I refuse to make food for my husband, he's allowed to eat at a restaurant. If I refuse to give him something to drink, he can buy something from a shop. If I refuse to have sex with him, he's allowed to firstly threaten me, then if I still refuse, he can beat me because he's not allowed to buy sex. I don't want to be beaten anymore. What should I do? Now, I don't know if that's a serious question, because there's a few people in here who write joke questions. So I'm not really sure if it's a real question or not. It was sometimes that they may be allowed to do that in some countries, but they're certainly not allowed to do that in most Western countries or a country like Australia, or I don't think even Singapore. So, I mean, even though it may be a religious right or an allowance, that does not make it ethical. And just because it said it's okay in religion doesn't mean it's okay in law. And I know I was very impressed with the French government in 2001, that's 9 years ago, they passed a law which limited religious freedom. You talk about religious freedom, and it's like this red rag that no one can go past religious freedom. And that's the biggest no-no. And the French government said, you can limit religious freedom when it is against human rights and fundamental human freedoms, then it is wrong. And so it's illegal to do things like that. You can practice whatever religion you want, but if that religion infringes on human rights and basic human freedoms, it is proscribed, it is illegal. And it's important for religions to submit to such human rights. The idea of religious freedom is not freedom at all. It's what we call the freedom to dominate maybe women or other people. It's not freedom at all. So really what religious freedom should be, it should be subject like every other
organization to, you know, basic standards of human rights, Buddhism as well. So I'm very strong on that. I remember I gave a talk recently on human on law and religion at University of Western Australia. And I was, of all the panel, I was the first to bring up religious freedom and say that is a myth. Religions should not be allowed freedom when they obviously do things which are oppressive and wrong. So, but if you're in that situation, that's a very tough one. And if your husband is like that, then it's not much of a marriage, basically. And you know, you really think that, you know, if he demands sex and he will beat you if you don't give it to him, I would actually think of maybe leaving. I say that very sort of seriously. Because what type of relationship is that? It's controlling, demeaning, and it's not religious at all. That's bad. Serious question. I, Paul Path, and Seven Enlightenment Factors, two different approaches or one? They are just one approach, just seen from different angles. So you can look at things from so many different ways, and that's actually how you look at Eightfold Path, Seven Enlightenment Factors. For those who can't count to eight, practice the Seven Enlightenment Factors. Ajahn Brahm, why sleep on the right side? Why not the left side? Any significance? Look, you've got to sleep on one side. I just keep the right side, okay? Just comfortable. If a sense object is constant, then it fades and disappears. Great. However, we learn that something exists which contact of... Oh, my goodness, here we go. This is... If a sense object is constant, then it fades and disappears. However, we learn that something exists with contact of object and consciousness, sheaves of reed. If one is removed, so does the other. It doesn't say if one is constant. How do we link both understandings together? Certainly, if something is constant, it does vanish because your brain cannot see or cannot perceive things which are always there. The sound of the fan, you know, the sound of the traffic in the distance, you know, the taste of your saliva, these are constant things which we don't perceive unless we really, you know, look for them. And it's the nature of the brain only to notice things which change, which means a lot of life you just cannot see because it's always there, always been there. And I use that for understanding insight, and I'll talk about that later on. But with consciousness and the objects of consciousness, remember these objects of consciousness is heaps of things. It's not one object of consciousness, it's not one type of consciousness. But it's a different metaphor, the sheaves of reed, when one is taken away, in other words, you don't have an object of consciousness, then the consciousness disappears. So in other words, you have like your taste consciousness. You have to have something to taste for that to actually to be there. But if that something to taste is constantly there, it disappears, and when that disappears, the taste consciousness disappears. If you get that one. If it doesn't, shut up and the question will disappear because we're not paying attention to it. Why can consciousness take the other five senses as an object, but the other five senses can't take consciousness as an object? What's so special about consciousness? That's why they say that... What is it called? A bird can't fly. No, a bird can fly. No, we haven't. That was that in Winnie the Pooh. Eccleston, Eccleston, Crickle. Sorry? That's right. That's right, yeah. A bird can fly, but a fly can't bird. So this is a poem. So in English literature. So by Winnie the Pooh. So consciousness, why can't consciousness take the other five senses as an object? The other five senses can't take consciousness as an object. The same reason why a bird can fly but a fly can't bird. That's the answer. So it's just language. In general, in general, is it more difficult for successful people to get into jhanas? Is this what you find in your teaching experience? What should they do? Give up their success and become a nobody? Actually, it's really the opposite, because usually a successful person is a happy person, because everybody knows that happiness precedes success.
If you haven't got passion for your job or for your work, whatever you do in life, if you haven't got passion for it, you don't enjoy it, you're never successful. So people who are successful are usually, you know, miserable to begin with. Which is why without that happiness they find it very difficult to get into deep meditation. But successful people have got an innate happiness to them, which makes it easier for them to actually get into jhanas. So people successful in the world usually are successful in meditation too. People who fail at everything, gee, you're really in big trouble. But don't worry, I can turn it around for you. Again, stick with me, you can make 100 million, get into jhanas and become a success story. Sometimes I can't feel the breath to concentrate on. Is it normal while meditating? Of course it is. You don't have to feel the breath. Be aware of something. So whatever you're aware of, just make peace with it. Be kind, be gentle. The breath will come to you eventually. So don't go searching for the breath. If you keep going searching for the breath, the reason why you can't feel the breath, I told you already, because you've been so cruel to your breath, you go looking for it, it's hiding. It's afraid of you. You know, you're just giving it such a difficult time, beating it up and telling it what to do. And so as soon as you go looking for it, you know, it's out the door. Hiding somewhere, that's why you can't find it. So you be kind, you be peaceful, and then the breath will come and look for you. Because it likes you. How do we dispel the impact of past negative lives? Okay. It's very easy to do. All negativity, you can just drop it straight away. You don't have to carry it. So if it's past negative lives, you know, it's just like a piece of shit from the past. And you look upon it with great mindfulness and it's beautiful. When you actually start to understand what negativity truly is, it's actually just black and white paper. It's what we add to the experiences of life. So, you know, whatever's happened to you in life, you know, is it good or is it bad? I've got time to tell you. You know the old good or bad story, who knows? Who knows what it is? You know, I lost a girlfriend when I was 20. Was it 20, 19 or something? And you know, we were together for a long time. Was it good, was it bad? Oh, I thought it was terrible at the time. But now I think, oh, thank God for that. So at the time you think it's terrible, but when you get wise you think what a wonderful thing it was. So the negative impact of past lives, when you see it clearly, actually it's all grist for the mill. So what a wonderful thing that was. Now you understand it. So you just embrace it and turn the shit into fertilizer, into beautiful mango trees and then mangoes. I've read and studied the Dharma Sutra as a layperson. I find it very beautiful and deep. I have not heard your thoughts on this sutra. Could you share your views on even a talk on this week, please? Okay, tomorrow. I always like doing new ones because you've heard all my talks so many times. Some of you have been coming to this retreat so many years and you're still not enlightened. I often say I must be a terrible, terrible, terrible teacher. Imagine if I was a teacher in grade 12 and you kept coming back year after year after year after year. They'd think it's not the student's fault, it's the teacher's fault, they have to keep coming back. I so want to make the most of my time here at Jhana Grove, but I have a cough and I can't do as much sitting meditation as I'd like to. Please advise. If you can't do sitting meditation, do coughing meditation. So how do you do coughing meditation? You cough. Just make it the most beautiful cough you can possibly do. Start doing the delightful cough meditation. In other words, don't fight it, just cough. And if you're afraid of disturbing other people, that's why we've got these personal rooms. You can go in your personal room, you can cough as much as you like, no one will hear you. So do your coughing meditation and just allow the cough to be. So remember the story of the anger eating demon? If you try and get rid of the cough, it gets worse. If you allow it to be, welcome cough, thank you for coming to visit me. How can I nurture you, cough? And then because of your kindness, you're making peace, you're being kind, you're being gentle. Then whether you're watching a cough or whether you're watching a nimitta, it's meditation.
Okay, so allow the cough to be. It's a good teacher for you. What advice would you give for someone who's considering whether to become a monk or not? Just do it. Look, you're considering it, and if you've got the chance. You know, there's this one guy some time ago, he came over here and he checked the place out. He really wanted to become a monk. And he said he went away just to fix up some things. About 2 months later, we got a message from him: I'm not going to become a monk anymore. I've fallen in love. So do it quickly. Otherwise, you lose the chance. Or become a nun before you got the chance. Could you please explain the concept of Mara? Yeah, you know, sort of Mara is the root word from which marriage comes from. Mara? Because you know what? Mara, actually, the concept of Mara is the controller. And this is fascinating because Mara, according to the Buddhist texts, is a leader of this realm called the Paranimitta Vasavati realm, the realm of devas who wield power over others' creations. This is the devas, the gods who get off on controlling. You know that people love that. Why does anybody want to become President of the United States? Or want to become sort of Prime Minister of Australia or boss? They're just into controlling. There's a certain amount of pleasure comes from being powerful. And people get off on that. Powerful, controlling. Those are the sorts of people who eventually become Mara. The control freak in chief. The most powerful being. And you all know Lord Acton. His favorite saying: power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And that's what happens with Mara. Pretty good guy to begin with, but when he gets into controlling, corrupts totally. Just like your will, it corrupts. But first of all, you know, you might do some good things. Be careful. Power corrupts, will corrupts. If you have a strong will, it corrupts you, absolutely. So that's Mara. So controlling is Mara. How do you stop that will? In the suttas, Mara would come up to try and disturb the Buddha or disturb others. And all that great monk or nun would do, I know you, Mara. Just to know and recognize this will for what it is, that's all you need. And then it vanishes. It can never affect you anymore. So insight, you don't have to fight Mara, because if you fight Mara, you get stronger. But if you just let it be, then Mara has to go away. Also, why did Mara follow the Buddha for several years after his enlightenment? Because the Buddha let go. And that really pissed off Mara, because he couldn't control this guy. He did everything trying to control him. But no way, just was letting go. Now this is what Mara is, and why Mara is enemy number one. As I said, will is enemy number one. And you take that to be your most cherished possession. That's called delusion. Last question, because I'm going late tonight, that's why I rushed off a bit. With regard to causes and conditions, how is it that we have responsibility? Why should I strive to be a better person where there is no self? Who am I is clearly conditioned, so where is the momentum to put effort to improving your mind? If you put effort into improving your mind, it gets worse. That's a big problem. In my room over the road, I have this pamphlet. It was from a scientific journal a few years ago in Jerusalem. The doctors went on strike, so they weren't trying to improve people's health. And the death rate plummeted. People were much more healthy when the doctors were on strike. That was true. A few doctors here. I can show it to you later on. It's just the same when the traffic lights, when they go out, the traffic flows more freely. When you stop striving, things become much easier. Try it. You become more successful. So, you have responsibility. Your responsibility is to let go. I've got a pretty successful monastery over the road. I don't control it. You know, they just run riot at that monastery. They don't run. They're really good monks. But you encourage. But you don't control. So that is actually the way. I remember this great monk. He's now the abbot of Wat Bapong, Ajahn Liam. I went to see him once to pay respects, and there is like a greeting. It was almost like a cultural, common, accepted way of meeting each other when you're abbots. And you say, "Are your monks easy to train?" And he said, "Yes, they're absolutely very easy to train." And this is in this big monastery, Wat Bapong, with hundreds of monks there. And I said, "How do you train them that they're so easy?" He said, "If they want to go to the left, I let them go to the left. If they want to go to the right, I let them go to the right. That's why they're so easy to train." And that's Ajahn Liam. He's a very great monk. So that's what I want to do. That means they're easy to train. You trust people. People become monks and novices, nuns. They don't become these to have an easy time because they really want to become enlightened. So your job is not to push them. Your job is to facilitate, to create the environment so that it happens. My job for you is to create the environment. That's why building this place and encouraging, giving some happiness, taking away your fears, to facilitate your ability to meditate. But I won't force you. So facilitation is all you need to do. So if you have responsibility, strive to be a better person. If you strive to be a better person, it means you don't love yourself as you are. You're denying yourself. In fact, you're hating yourself. You think you're not good enough. And that's one of the biggest reasons why people can't become better people. So just accept yourself for who you are. Don't strive to be a better person. Just love yourself for who you are. The door of my heart is open to me precisely as I am. Then you become a better person. You want to be a better person, and you just get worse. You love yourself for who you are, and you get better. That's the psychology which the Buddha found years ago. And that's why we teach it to people these days. Just be at peace with yourself. And everything gets better. Trying to perfect yourself, and perfect yourself, and perfect yourself. You just get so frustrated, depressed, because it doesn't work. That's how it really works. So, to strive to be a better person, just love yourself for who you are. You are good enough. And you sit here saying, "My meditation's good enough. My meditation's good enough. My meditation's good enough." Now that's only the beginning. My meditation's good enough. My meditation's good enough. My meditation's good enough. My meditation's good enough. My meditations, it's really good enough. Because that is the path, that's actually how it works. First of all, you go to sort of to sloth and torpor or restlessness. Just wait for a while. Just the same as that old story, you know, I hold a cup, and you've all seen me do this before, and I ask, "Is it still?" And it's not still. How do you get it still? You put it down. You try this when you go back to your room. You hold it still, and it's always moving, but not much. This is when you meditate. If you hold, put forth effort, you can keep your mind reasonably still, but it's still moving. It can't be perfectly still. You put it down. Watch. It actually moves more. As soon as you let go, there's more movement. So when you do let go, you have more restlessness, and have more sloth and torpor. Leave it alone. Because then it will start to slow down and settle down naturally. Soon you'll be back to your normal state, you know, the normal state of stillness, which is, you know, usually you can't go beyond, but now you go beyond that. So when you let go, be prepared to have more restlessness, more sloth and torpor. But just be patient, because it will start to slow down. And you'll soon go far deeper into stillness and peace than you've ever experienced before. Just like the cup, perfectly still. But when you first put it down, it moves more than normal. Remember that. So there you go. If you have all the information necessary, all the encouragement necessary, as the Buddha said, here are the empty places, here are the secluded places, meditate and become enlightened. Or if you really want to, you can go back to bed. Tomorrow's another day. Don't sort of push yourself too far. If you've got energy, stay and meditate. If you want to go and have a rest, take a rest. So just the evening is yours. But remember, if you were at home, what time would you normally go to bed? So why do you have to go to bed so early here? So if you've got energy, carry on. If you haven't got energy, take a rest. And you don't always have to meditate in this room. You meditate sort of by the stupa, if you like. You can meditate in your room, which is like a little cave. So enjoy the time here. And I'll see you tomorrow. Enlightened. Free. Why not? Tonight might be your night. It's going to happen one time. Who knows? Maybe tonight. Okay, good night, everybody.